Welcome back to the Universalis podcast. I am Martin Kohinski, the creator of Universalis, and in this episode I'll be looking at the highlights of the week ahead, starting with Sunday, the 25th of May. Last week we had Popes Leo I, II, III, and IV. All of them were saints from the early days of the official church. They were revered and respected together, and were even for a while interred in the same tomb. This week is a little embarrassing, because Popes Leo V, VI, VII, and VIII date from an embarrassing period, the 10th century. This was a time of chaos for Rome. Nobody was really in charge, so everybody had a go at once. Historical sources are scarce, and they are mostly written by people who had some sort of political axe to grind. But Pope Leo V was probably pope for the month of August 903, after which a fellow cardinal, Christopher, threw him into prison and declared himself pope. They were then both displaced by Pope Sergius III, who imprisoned both Leo and Christopher, and may or may not have put them to death. After that, things became even less orderly. Marozia, previously the mistress of Pope Sergius III, appointed pope after pope, including Leo VI, Stephen VII, and her own son, John XI, or something like that. Anyway, for what it is worth, Pope Leo VI was pope in the second half of 928 for just over 7 months. When John XI died, the ruler of Rome appointed Pope Leo VII to be pope, a post he never really wanted. He was pope from 936 to 939. It isn't clear if he accomplished much. As for Pope Leo VIII, he was a layman when the Emperor Otto decided to make him pope, so he was ordained priest one day and bishop the next, which did not really legalize the matter. There was then a complicated tangle involving three simultaneous popes, but it seems that for 8 months from July 964, everybody really did think of Leo VIII as the pope. If it is wearisome to listen to all this, think how much more wearisome it must have been to live through it. If you had been living through it, it must have seemed quite obvious that Rome and the papacy were just going to sink into the mud and never get out. And then something amazing happened. The mud began to fizz. The church that everyone thought was moribund started to wake up and set about reforming herself. In 1048, Pope Damasus II died. He was succeeded by Bruno of Eggisheim-Dagsburg, who was a relative of the Emperor Conrad. He had been bishop of the small diocese of Toul, which is now in eastern France, for 20 years. He had looked after the city in times of famine and war, and had even brokered a peace settlement between the Empire and the Kingdom of France. Bruno was chosen to be pope by an assembly at the German city of Worms. His choice was approved by the Emperor himself, but Bruno wanted more. He accepted the post on the condition that he was properly and freely elected by the clergy and people of Rome. So to Rome he went, dressed humbly as a pilgrim, to apply for the post of servant of the servants of God. He was warmly welcomed and elected pope, and took the name Leo IX. Among the people who accompanied him to Rome was a monk called Hildebrand. He will become important later on. With all these ups and downs, and chaos about who was pope and who wasn't, and who ought to be appointed pope anyway, an enormous pressure for reform was growing in the church. Leo IX began this process. He abolished the buying and selling of ecclesiastical posts. He abolished the appointment of bishops by local kings and rulers. He insisted on the celibacy of the clergy, not only, as now, to leave them undistracted to look after their flocks, but also to stop them establishing dynasties and endowing their children and grandchildren with any lucrative posts that were going. It is one thing to abolish something, it is another to make it be abolished. This reform was not accomplished at the stroke of a pen. In fact, it took decades of disagreement, conflict, and even war. But still, it was begun. Leo toured Europe, seeing for himself the state of the church in various territories, and setting in motion the process of reform. Of course, Rome would not be Rome without its attackers. It had had the Goths and the Huns and the Vandals and the Saracens, and now it was being attacked by the Normans. You might say that the Normans were Vikings in disguise. They had Frenchified themselves and settled in northwestern France, the part which became known as Normandy, but they had not forgotten their invading habits. The English know this because they sometimes count their history as starting with their conquest by Duke William of Normandy in 1066. The Normans also conquered Sicily a little before this and threatened those parts of southern Italy which were still under the control of the Eastern Roman Empire. Leo IX went to their defence, but in 1053 he lost an important battle and was captured. His captors treated him with all the respect and honour due to their pope and eventually released him, but he died the following year, discouraged and disappointed. Still, Leo's defeat by the Normans is the least interesting facet of his reign. What Leo's reign and actions show is that even when the Church is at her most dominated by the powers of this world, she has an impetus to holiness within her. It can be held back for a while, but sooner or later it bursts out. I mentioned Hildebrand as someone who came south to Rome with Pope Leo IX. He is actually a saint in his own right, as Pope Gregory VII, and his feast day is this Sunday, the 25th of May. Since it is a Sunday this year, we don't actually celebrate it, but we shouldn't forget him. As soon as Hildebrand had reached Rome with the new Pope Leo IX, he played an important part in the Church, both in her external diplomacy and internally. Peace was established with the Normans who had conquered southern Italy. After Leo IX died, another scandalous situation of two popes at once was peacefully resolved. The most important reform in that direction was that in future popes were to be elected by the cardinals only. We saw this process in action a few weeks ago. Very little changed in the 10 centuries since it was set up. When Hildebrand was elected pope by the cardinals in conclave, to the wild acclamation of the people of Rome, as Pope Gregory VII, he pushed forward this process of reform. The fight was long, but in the end it was successful. The Church was the Church, not a toy for princes or emperors to play with. The strength of a Church which was her own Church would be seen in the 12th and 13th centuries. Only a strong and confident Church would feel safe enough to allow revolutionary movements such as the Franciscans and Dominicans to become official religious orders. Only a strong and confident Church would encourage the setting up of universities that were independent of both the kings and the bishops. And when new ideas came from the East or were rediscovered from the ancient world, it needed that same strength and confidence to allow them to be discussed and thrashed out instead of squashing the discussion before it began. You might say that without the reforms of Leo IX, Gregory VII, and their successors, St. Thomas Aquinas could not have happened. That is enough of popes for this week. Next week we'll be moving on to the splendid and flawed Pope Leo X. Meanwhile, on Monday the 26th, we celebrate St. Philip Neri, a 16th century priest and the founder of the Congregation of the Oratory, a congregation which still thrives today. The Oratory is particularly relevant to England because the first two oratories in the country were founded by St. John Henry Newman and his fellow convert, Father Frederick William Faber. But we have to be careful here. Saints are not about religious orders or congregations, and if we start thinking about them by thinking about the orders they founded, we are in a sense thinking backwards. By thinking backwards, I mean looking up at the statue of a saint in a niche high above our heads and being impressed by how great he is. St. Philip Neri was a priest. St. Philip Neri was the founder of an order. St. Philip Neri was a saint. Which is to say, he was not like us. He was not like us. He was not like us. We gaze up at him until we get a crick in our neck. Then we thank God that such holy people exist, and go home massaging our neck and thanking God that we are not one of those holy people. You can call our state of alienation or a state of safety. It doesn't matter which. The thing is, it risks becoming a state of laziness. God has given each of us a vocation to be us, to become who God wants us to be. In common decency, we ought to try to discover what that vocation is, and even try to live it. Most of us are not called to be priests or nuns or monks, but we are still called to something. What we are called to may resemble ordinary life quite closely, or it may not, but there will always be a divine light shining through it. One of the jobs of the Church is to canonize a wide enough range of saints that each of us can say about one of them, "This one is a bit like me." This is why Pope John Paul II canonized so many saints of so many different kinds. Anyway, to come back to St. Philip Neri, it is best to look at him forwards, not backwards. We don't look at the saint, the priest, the founder of an order. We look at Philip Neri, not Philip Neri who's going to be a priest, not Philip Neri who's going to do this or that, but just plain Philip Neri, the son of his father, a prayerful boy who in 1533, at the age of 18, threw up a promising job to go off and become the Apostle of Rome. He was about as impractical and unmoney-minded as Francis of Assisi all those centuries before, but before he starved, a kind resident of Rome took him in, gave him a room and food, and made him tutor to his sons. Philip visited the hospitals. He talked about God to everyone he met, by the grace of God, not as an annoying maniac, but as someone who was able to speak to the heart. Many who met him determined to work with him and be like him, and some kind of brotherhood grew up round him. Philip longed to leave Rome and live the life of a solitary hermit, but his confessor told him, "Let Rome be your desert." He was a friend of Ignatius Loyola and had the idea of going to India as a missionary, but he was told, "Let Rome be your India," and so he stayed. He never intended to be a priest, but his confessor told him he must because it would help his apostolate, so in his mid-30s he did. Gradually, Philip's vocation became clearer. He built an oratory over his church, where he invented services consisting of spiritual readings and hymns, together with talks given by laymen, the origins of the oratorio. Other clergy were attracted to join him in his work, and so in the end the congregation of the oratory was born. There are oratories all over the place to this day. Philip Neri died in Rome in 1595. The thing about looking at the life of a saint forwards like this is that one sees how normal each stage of it was. Each activity followed smoothly from its predecessor. Each activity, without any planning, led on to the next. You could say, in general, that the career of a saint is not a career at all, in the sense that a career is a planned thing, but in a saint's life, what happens, happens. Looking at it forwards, we can see that Philip Neri, even if a priest, even if a founder, even if a saint, is not as far above us as we think. He is not distant. He is one of us. You can call this reassuring, and it is, but you can also call it unsettling, because it means that you and I can do things, and do things that matter. We can follow our vocations, and God will make something of them. We have no excuse for spending our lives sitting on the sofa of mediocrity. Admittedly, it was a special time. It is worth remembering that. Philip Neri was a friend of St. Ignatius Loyola, who also founded an order. He was a contemporary of St. Therese of Avila and St. John of the Cross, who turned the Carmelites upside down. He was a friend of Pope Gregory XIV, who issued decrees demanding that the natives enslaved by the Spaniards in the Philippines be liberated and given compensation. The century of all these people, the 16th century, was in fact a century of reform. Protestant historians and lazy Catholics in Protestant countries call this the Counter-Reformation. It was nothing of the sort. Counter-Reformation sounds like an undoing, and on the contrary, the Catholic Reformation was a doing, a bursting out of the Spirit in all directions, most especially through the medium of the laity. Jesus told us that the kingdom of heaven is like the leaven which a woman mixed into 3 measures of flour until it was leavened all through. I don't know if you have tried this. You mix the flour and the water and the yeast, and you put a small lump of leavened dough in a huge bowl and put a cloth over it to keep off the draughts. You put it in a warm place next to the stove and you go away. When you come back, a bit late, having forgotten about it, the dough has expanded to fill the whole bowl. It has pushed the cloth away. Bits of it have overflowed and fallen onto the floor, and the whole thing is still bubbling. Here is another parable which didn't make it into the gospel. The kingdom of heaven is like the yeast which a boy took and shook up with 3 gallons of water and sugar and put it into bottles to make ginger beer. The fizz grew and the pressure grew, and some of the corks popped out, and when they didn't pop, some of the bottles exploded, and you could hear a bang, bang, bang from the larder where they were stored. This is very much what the Catholic Reformation was like. The Spirit struck, that is the best way of saying it. Some Carmelites got the idea that they would like to be Carmelite Carmelites, and after a lot of argument, a reformed branch was established. Some Franciscans got the idea of being Franciscan Franciscans, and out of that impetus grew the Capuchins. A fashionable 30-year-old man dreaming of a glorious military career went and got his leg broken by a cannonball, and the Jesuits happened. Everywhere there were confraternities, congregations, brotherhoods, bubbling up out of nowhere, it seemed, as the leaven of the Spirit took hold. For another example, we celebrate the Visitation this Saturday, the 31st. Well then, in 1610, St. Jane Frances de Chantal started the Congregation of the Visitation, the Visitandine Nuns. The 16th century might have ended, but the fizz carried on. I don't really want us to admire those times, the way we admire the statue of a saint up there in his niche. Rather, let's think, where are we now? The work of the Spirit is like yeast, it is invisible. Hidden away in the ginger beer bottles of the spirit of the age, is nothing happening? Are we all lazy, complacent, ready to delegate the work of God to institutions? Or is something happening inside those bottles? Are we all itching to do something, to get something done, to make something happen, and just don't know how yet? From the outside, these two situations look exactly the same. But let's not try to stand outside our age and make an assessment of it. Instead, let's find someone to stand shoulder to shoulder with and get to work. That's all for this week. If you'd like to write to us about anything, send an email to universalis@universalis.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Have a good week in every sense, and let's pray for one another.